Yeah, thanks, Neil, for the nice introduction, and thanks everyone for coming. It's nice to be back at Perimeter. I remember visiting a few years ago. It's been really nice being up there. I hope you're yeah, it's not too bad with the pandemic, and I guess it's a good remote place to get through the pandemic. So I hope all is good with everyone. So I want to talk today about some work I've done over the past couple of years, mostly on precision cosmology using the clustering of galaxies. And as you all know, the kind of rough picture of cosmology is that, well, it's kind of shown here, right? We have cosmic inflation early on in the first fraction of a second, where there are quantum fluctuations that are kind of stretched out during some fast expansion phase early on. The fluctuations freeze them, they become classical, and they form the seeds for the cosmic microwave background radiation, which we observe. And they also form the seeds for the distribution of galaxies that we see. Later on, there is the second phase of accelerated expansion due to dark energy. And you know, that kind of is something that I guess people are very interested right now to understand better what this is. Now, all the kind of building blocks that we have in the standard cosmological model are to some extent unknown, right? So for this cosmic inflation, we don't really know what the particle physics model is that led to the rapid expansion early on. We don't really know how the universe began. For dark energy, we don't know what causes this second epoch of rapid expansion. Is it a cosmological constant? Is general relativity broken somehow? It's kind of a big mystery. Then there's dark matter, which, you know, we have a lot of observational evidence that it has to be there, but we don't know what particle or what particles it's made of. And finally, there are relativistic particles, and there are questions about them, like what is the mass or the mass hierarchy of neutrinos, for example, and are there any additional light particles? Now, in this talk, I'm going to focus on the first question, this early phase of cosmic inflation and what we can do to perhaps understand better what was going on there. So it turns out one can kind of classify models for this phase into two broad categories. There can be single field inflation or multi-field inflation. If there's single field inflation, then these quantum fluctuations early on are Gaussian. And what that means is because there's a linear transfer of the initial conditions to the cosmic microwave background radiation, that the consequence is that the cosmic microwave background radiation is also Gaussian distributed. And the distribution of galaxies you can think of as basically a field that forms at the peaks of a Gaussian random field. So that's what happens in single field inflation. If you instead have multi-field inflation, then the quantum fluctuations can be non-Gaussian, so they can deviate from a normal distribution. What that means is that the CMB is also not Gaussian, and the galaxies form at the peaks of a non-Gaussian field. And we can look for that observationally, and Perimeter has some experts on this, both for the CMB and for the galaxy, so you know this very well. So just to kind of give the big picture again, right, we have this cosmic inflation, then we can either have single field where you have Gaussian fluctuations and the skewness is basically zero. We typically call the skewness FNL or some non-linearity parameter. Right, so for this Gaussian fluctuations, that would be close to zero. If we have multi-field inflation, that can be non-zero, and we would kind of get a skewed distribution of fluctuations. And this is kind of showing the distribution of initial conditions, if you want. Now, what are the tightest limits today? It turns out that they come from the cosmic microwave background radiation, and they are shown here from the Planck, the European Planck satellite. It made a measurement with an error bar of FNL of 5, and the measurement is consistent with 0, so that means the fluctuations are consistent with being Gaussian, and we have not detected any kind of deviation from this Gaussianity. In the future, we're trying to do better than that, and the hope is to use galaxies for that. The idea here is that basically the signal-to-noise squared scales like the number of observations that you make or the number of 3D modes that you observe or the volume. And if you're looking at this three-dimensional distribution of galaxies, you can make more measurements than if you just look at this 2D surface of the CMB. Of course, that assumes that you have enough galaxies, and you know, in the CMB you can go very high resolution. So it's not completely clear, like you know, how the trade-off goes. But it turns out that there's kind of some realistic hopes that using galaxies we might be able to improve over what the CMB is giving us. And so this is now the question is, like, how can we actually see this multi-field inflation in the distribution of galaxies? So I'm showing here some plots from a famous paper by Neil from 2007, where on top you there's basically a simulation of the distribution. This is actually just dark matter, I think. But this is the distribution of large-scale structure. If there is single-field inflation and galaxies evolve from normally distributed initial conditions, if you compare that on the bottom, there's the large-scale structure for multi-field inflation, where this FNL parameter is 5,000, which is actually 1,000 times larger than the current limits and 5,000 times larger than the signal we like to look for. But what you can see here is that there are kind of peaks in this distribution are stronger and the voids are kind of deeper. Right, so you can try to look for a signal like that to see this, this FNL signature in the galaxies. Now, how would you do that in practice? How would you look for such a signal? You could just count the number of peaks using some definition of peaks. You could count the number of voids. You could look at a histogram of the galaxy number density and just see if there, you know, if there's some kind of skewed distribution there. You could directly measure things like the skewness or kurtosis. All of these are kind of one-point measures, right? You could also make kind of more kind of spatial measures by measuring, for example, the skewness of 3D Fourier modes and kind of, you know, the coupling between different 3D Fourier modes. And there are many more ideas that have been proposed in the literature. Right, if we want to do this in practice, there are several challenges. And in this talk, I'm trying to, you know, tell you about what these challenges are and some ideas how we might be able to address them. So the first challenge I'm already said is that the signal is really tiny, right? You can barely see it by eye for a signal that's 5,000 times larger than what we are after. So you need to use statistical techniques to measure the signal from real data. The second challenge is that the data is a complicated nonlinear function of the initial conditions, which means that it's not easy to model the data. And finally, the data is not normally distributed. So it's not clear what is the optimal data analysis method. And that's the reason why on the previous slide, there were different ideas for doing the data analysis, right? It's not clear what is the optimal method. And therefore people keep proposing new methods, right? So it's kind of fun because it means there's work to do to get better methods, but at the same time, it's a challenge, like what is kind of a good analysis method for data like this. And it turns out that it's not only cosmic inflation that's kind of limited by these challenges, but all the other points I mentioned also benefit from making progress on these questions. Right, so let me start by tackling this problem of the tiny signal. And I should say, like, if you have any questions, feel free to interrupt me anytime. Okay, so let's say we want to measure the power spectrum as a summary statistic, right? So this is basically asking what's the squared size of fluctuations, or kind of the RMS size of fluctuations on different scales. And as an example, I'm showing this plot here, which shows you what a measured power spectrum might look like. On the left side of the plot is the power spectrum of very large scales. There are only very few of these large scales that fit into a finite volume. So the error bars are large, cannot constrain what the power spectrum is for these kind of large scale modes. As we go to the right of the plot, we measure the power spectrum on smaller scales. There are more small scale fluctuations that fit into a finite volume. So we can measure this power spectrum with smaller error bars. Now this uncertainty in the measurement, or this error bar, is just the error on the mean. We usually call it sample variance, or if we make a measurement on real data, it would be the cosmic variance, right? It's like how many modes fit into the volume that we observe. Now, what multi-field inflation does is it enhances this power spectrum, but only on very large scales. And the reason for that is that basically this multi-field inflation couples peaks to the gravitational potential, and the gravitational potential goes like 1/k² times the density, where k here is the spatial wave number. And you can only see this on very large scales where the error bars are large. Now let's say we wanted to measure this multi-field inflation. Here's to do that we can divide by the expectation for single-field inflation, right? So let's say we measure this wiggly power spectrum shown in the solid line here, and we divide it by the power spectrum we would expect on average for single-field inflation. We could see a curve like this, right? And what I'm showing here is really just a toy example where the wiggly curve is a Gaussian random field that's drawn from this dash. Around this dashed curve, right? And what we want to do is we want to ask the question: does this fluctuating power spectrum come from the dashed curve or from the dotted curve, right? So the dashed curve would be this multi-field inflation where the power spectrum goes like 1/k² on large scales, where single-field inflation is just constant here because I'm dividing by the single-field inflation expectation. Now what you see is that the error bars are so large on large scales on the left of the plot that you cannot really given the measurement, you cannot really say if this is coming from multi-field or single-field inflation. You cannot distinguish the dashed from the dotted line because the error bars are too large. Now, what can we do about that? Imagine we had a second measurement of the of similar fluctuations, but fluctuations that don't respond to this multi-field inflation. So fluctuations that are the same for single-field and multi-field inflation. And it turns out dark matter is such a field. Then if we take the ratio of these two curves, we find something that has no error bars, assuming that the two curves are perfectly correlated. And we can measure that ratio between the galaxy fluctuations and the dark matter fluctuations without any error bars in here. Right? And then we would see, okay, it's not a constant, but it has this 1/k² shape. So we can observe multi-field inflation in that way. Now that's kind of a magic that happened here, right? We had like some very noisy measurement, and by adding another noisy measurement, we kind of got rid of the noise. So you could ask, what really happened here, right? What is the magic that is going on here? And we can look at this kind of in a simple example, right? Imagine you come up with some new image compression algorithm, and you're asking, is this better than JPEG compression? One way to to test this would be to ask people to rate JPEG compressed images. You give them 100 images, they should rate how good the pictures look like. You can also do this with other images that are compressed with your new algorithm, right? And then you compare the ratings for the two kind of compression algorithms to see what's the winner. And you would get a curve like here on the bottom right, where you have like some ratings for the new algorithm and some ratings for the JPEG algorithm. Each of them has some error bar that's basically given by the number of images you show to people, right? And then if you throw in enough images, in the end, the error bars should be small enough that you can separate which algorithm is better. You know, and again, this is the example that I had previously when we only measure the power spectrum. We are limited by the error on the mean or the number of observations that we make. Now, in contrast, you could say take a single image, make a JPEG compression and a new algorithm compression, and then ask, given that single image, what's the best algorithm to compress that image? And if there's a clear difference, then you can really see the difference of the algorithms from a single image, right? So now you're not subject to this sample variance any longer, right? You can you've kind of canceled the sample variance, and you can say which algorithm works better with a single example. And that's kind of similar to this ratio that I showed previously, dividing the galaxy distribution by the dark matter distribution. Excuse me. Okay, so that's kind of the whole magic that's going on here, right? We're just comparing the same example. Now, I told you that we can use the distribution of dark matter to do this trick, but how do we actually see the distribution of dark matter, right? Dark matter is dark, so we cannot directly see it. But what we can do is we can use gravitational lensing to measure the dark matter. And this is kind of illustrated here using lensing of the cosmic microwave background. So we have this CMB as a background screen. The light comes to us basically on a straight line. But if there are structures in between, then the light is slightly bent around that structure. And we can reconstruct how that bending happened to infer where the dark matter was along the line of sight. So this is kind of a nice picture of this effect, right? And how does this work in detail? Well, if you imagine you have this cosmic microwave background radiation here, you can measure the power spectrum in each kind of local patch. And if there's no lensing, then this power spectrum would be the same in each patch because the CMB is isotropic. Now, if there are structures between us and the CMB in these patches, then that would basically magnify or demagnify or shrink all the structures within that patch. And what that means is if you look at the local power spectrum, all the features in that power spectrum would kind of shift to the left or to the right, depending on if you have some underdense or overdense region between you and the CMB. And that's what we can measure, right? We can basically measure the local power spectrum in each small patch and see if it kind of deviates a little bit to the left or to the right from the mean. And we can use that to kind of infer if there was an overdense or underdense region along the line of sight in a given direction. And people have done that with great success. So here, and there have been better measurements since then. I probably should have included them here, but this is kind of just one example using Planck data, where you can see here the reconstructed distribution of dark matter along the line of sight in different directions on the sky. And right now, this is being improved a lot by ground-based experiments like ACT and CMB, and ACT and SPT, and also Simons Observatory, and CMBS4 in the future. So that's pretty exciting, and we can use this dark matter distribution to do that sample variance cancellation trick that I mentioned earlier, comparing the distribution of galaxies against the distribution of dark matter. Right. So if we do some kind of forecast for this, this is what we find. And I guess the exact numbers depend on how you do the forecast and, you know, what you kind of assume and everything. But I guess, broadly speaking, the conclusion is that this looks promising in the sense that you can improve over the current limits from the CMB. Right, so what you see here is the uncertainty on this FNL parameter that I mentioned earlier. Currently, the uncertainty is 5. So that's the 1 sigma error bar shown in gray here. And then with these future experiments, we can hope to get an uncertainty of 2 or maybe 1, depending on what experiment we look at and how large an angular scale we're able to analyze. Right, and it seems like using this sample variance cancellation trick, you can gain something like a factor of 2, which is really important in this kind of in these constraints where, you know, every 10% that you're better is kind of important given how hard the measurements are.
Marcel, can I ask? So your CMB lensing map is a two-dimensional map, and you're comparing that to a three-dimensional galaxy map.
Yeah.
So for this sample variance, you know, trick to work, do you have to convert your galaxies into the, like, I mean, like, do you also, like, well, do you have to project the galaxy map into a 2D map to compare to the CMB? Or not?
Yeah, I mean, that I think you can think of it that way. And that's kind of the intuition we also had, right? So we were kind of thinking of having these galaxies in different redshift slices, and then you can kind of reweight them such that you reproduce your CMB lensing kernel along the line of sight. So you're kind of making, you're kind of using the galaxies to make a fake CMB lensing map, I guess. And then you cross-correlating them. And you know, you don't have to do this, right? I mean, this is one way to think about that. You can also just, you know, I mean, in the end, it's the same as just using all the cross-correlations between, like, you know, using the galaxies in different redshift slices, cross-correlating them with each other and with the CMB, and then just using all the power spectra and, you know, taking all covariances into account. And then get that sample variance trick. But I mean, to some extent, that sample variance trick is kind of a nice way to think about it. But in the end, what it really means for doing this forecast, it just means that you have to include the covariances, right? So you include like all the crosstalk between all the observables. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a good question.
Okay, great. Thanks, Marcel.
Are there more questions? Okay, if not, let me continue. So this is kind of like, you know, one idea about how, you know, how we can go about this, go about finding this tiny signal. So let's go to this second question of how do we model the data, right? Given that there is such a nonlinear and complicated transfer from the initial conditions to the observed distribution of galaxies. So this is kind of how I can think about this evolution. So we have some initial conditions that are in a simple single field inflation case, just a Gaussian Brennan field. Then we have some gravitational evolution, and we also have some gas physics, and they depend on physical parameters, right? And then in the end, they lead to the galaxies that we observe in galaxy surveys. Right, so we start from something simple on the left, then there's some complicated nonlinear transfer happening to get what we observe. Now, usually the way we analyze this is that we say we compute a summary statistic from the observable, for example, the power spectrum or the two-point correlation function. And then we have some physical parameters we have, and we kind of make models that predict what the summary statistic looks like given the physical parameters. And we also have nuisance parameters that, for example, parameterize galaxy bias, you know, where the galaxies form given the dark matter. And this is kind of a big industry, and this is kind of the standard how this data is analyzed. However, there are some kind of concerns here, and the authors in this paper mentioned that, and also many other papers, right? There can be overfitting, right? So what you see here is there are maybe 50 data points and 10 free parameters, right? So it's there's kind of a danger that your model is kind of too flexible to fit so few data points. Right, and the question is like, do our models really work, or, you know, do we just have something that's flexible enough that happens to fit whatever the few data points are here that we measure? Also note that the error bars are really strong function of wave number here, so the fit is really dominated by the smallest scales, and, you know, it's not really clear if it also works on the larger scale. So there's kind of you know, it's kind of like some it's not so easy to kind of test your theoretical models of these summary statistics, because you have large error bars and you have a lot of free parameters, and you have smooth curves with very few data points that you're trying to fit here. And of course, you know, people are very careful, so I don't think it's a real concern, but, you know, it's like, you know, you have to be careful, I guess. So this is kind of the standard approach, and what people have proposed is kind of an alternative approach, which is to say, let's forget about the summary statistics and try to model the data directly, and kind of using a forward model, right? And so here the idea would really be, you take some initial conditions, you have some kind of prescription that tells you where a galaxy would form given the initial conditions, given the, you know, overdense and underdense regions in the initial conditions. And you do this really in a three-dimensional way, right? So every three-dimensional position, you would predict if there's a galaxy or not. And of course, simulations can do that, but they are very expensive, right? So we are trying to find other ways to do that. So the benefits of using these 3D fields rather than summary statistics are, first, we might hope that there's less overfitting, because we have you know, less than 10 parameters to describe more than a million galaxy positions, typically. There's no sample variance here, so we can really use small volumes and high resolution simulations to test models. We don't have to use these huge simulations to get small error bars, right? In any kind of small volume, we can already test the model. And this is kind of interesting if you want to test things like, you know, if you want to test a model on hydro simulations, for example. Then we are kind of measuring all endpoint functions simultaneously, right? Because we're really asking in each pixel how similar are the model and the and the ground truth, which is either simulation or the observation. And we don't have, you know, by making this point-to-point comparison, we are kind of also making sure that all of the summary statistics you could possibly form are the same, right? Because if the fields are the same at the pixel level, all the statistics you form from it also have to be the same. Then it's easy to isolate the mistakes of the model, because you can just look at the residual in the 3D space between the model and the ground truth. And this approach can be useful for things like a field level likelihood, where you're trying to estimate parameters by writing down a likelihood at the field level, not at the summary statistic level. And you might be able to use this for initial condition reconstruction. So the questions we studied are, how well do analytical models generally work? How correlated is the galaxy density with the initial conditions? And what are the properties of the model error? So again, this is kind of the setup that we have. We have some initial conditions. This is a Gaussian random field in a 3D box. Then we have a simulation that generates synthetic galaxies. And then we have a theoretical model. And in our case, that's just a simple regression that makes a prediction where galaxies would form. The simulation that we use here is an n-body simulation that uses Yufeng's MP gadget code. We ran it on a local cluster at IAS, and it's kind of like, for the experts here, it's 1500 cube particles, using 4000 time steps, and it's kind of using a higher resolution for the force computation. Now, this is the simplest comparison that we did, where on top you see the simulation results, or the galaxy density that we get from the simulation. And in the lower panel, I show just a linear regression, where I'm basically taking the dark matter field, I multiply it by some constant, which is the linear bias, and I compare the, and I just plot the result, basically. So this is basically just the rescaled dark matter. What you see is that there is a reasonably good prediction on large scales. If you kind of like smear out the field, the fields, they look kind of similar, but we're clearly missing some structure on small scales. So how can we do better? There's this effective field theory approach where basically you're on top of this kind of linear term in the dark matter density, you're adding nonlinear terms in the dark matter density, and you're doing this in a systematic way, adding all the terms that are allowed by the symmetries of the property, by the symmetries of the problem that you're looking at. And it turns out there are not that many. So at second order, there's only a squared dark matter density and the tidal term, at least in this kind of simple setup. And then at cubic order, there are more terms. Now what we do, so usually what people do is they would take this model, they compute a summary statistic, and then they, the summary statistic would depend on these bias parameters. And you can fit the summary statistics to obtain the bias parameters B1, B2, B3, and so on. What we do here is a little bit different. So what we do is we really regard these as regression coefficients. So we are saying, given the 3D density of galaxies on the left, we are trying to find the bias parameters on the right that minimize the mean squared error between the left-hand side and the right-hand side, right? So we would basically get a B1 such that the mean squared difference between B1 dark matter and delta galaxy is the smallest, and we would also get the B2 such that, this kind of difference is minimized. And when we do that, we get a much better agreement, right? So you see in the bottom panel, you see what we get from this kind of nonlinear regression setup, where we include cubic and quadratic operators on top of the linear operators, on top of the linear operator, and by eye it looks really similar now. Of course, there are three parameters.
Are there here? Sorry, I mean.
Sorry.
Like how many parameters?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly, there are three parameters here, and I think in this case, it's maybe six parameters or something like that.
Like what you were saying, I thought, so for each K bin, you have three parameters, no?
That's right, yes. So there's some kind of, that's right. I should probably say that. So what we do is we fit this in Fourier space. So basically this B1, B2 and so on are all functions of K. So then you get a large number of parameters, something like 100 or so. But then what we find is that these coefficients as a function of K are smooth functions as a function of K. So we can fit them with a six parameter model. And so basically there are maybe two or three parameters that go into B1. And then the B2, B3, and all the higher order terms we can just set to a constant to be K independent. And when we use that kind of six parameter parameterization of these fitted regression coefficients, then we get a good result. So yeah, you're right. There's like some intermediate step where we have like a lot of parameters, but then we find that they're not really necessary. We can kind of throw them away, just use fewer parameters, like six or so, and still get a good result. Mm-hmm. But still, I mean, it's like, you know, it's a fit, right? It's not like, we have to fit parameters and then we kind of get a reasonable agreement. And I mean, yeah, and one can do this more quantitatively, right? And, this is just a nice picture. We can kind of.
Yeah, may I ask you? Mm-hmm. So this delta M in this expansion, so is it a Volt field or initial mm-hmm. field?
Yeah, that's something that confused us a lot, right? So what is the dark matter field that we should put in there? And there are many different choices you can take. You can take the initial field. You can take the evolved field from the simulation, right? We have the dark matter field from the simulation. We can just use that. We can use some perturbation theory prediction for the late time dark matter density. And there are different kind of choices of what kind of perturbation theory you want to use for the evolved field. We've played with all of these things. And what we found is that what works best is if we use some kind of Lagrangian perturbation theory dark matter here. So basically what we want is we want the initial conditions, but including the bulk flows.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and the idea would be that, I guess I should step ahead, right? So if you don't include the bulk flows, you get something like on the left. So basically all the galaxies would end up at a slightly wrong position. So if we compute this pixel level mistake that the model makes, it would be really large because everything is just, you know, in the wrong place. So if we compare the model and the simulation at a given place, we'd always get a large mistake. So we have to include these large bulk flows to get the prediction and the simulation to be coherent and to match.
Mm-hmm.
And we, so this is a picture, but we really see this when we measure the power spectrum of the model error, right? So what is shown here in the purple, for example, is what we would, or yeah, I guess in the light purple, is what we would get if we use the dark matter density that we obtained from the simulation, right? So squaring that is a very bad idea because it has a lot of small scale structure, and squaring that small scale structure would completely screw up the large scale models in terms of. And so that's kind of what you see on the left side of that plot. But what this nonlinear dark matter density has is it has the right bulk flow. So on small scales, it kind of looks reasonable. If we instead use a perturbation theory model where we use Eulerian perturbation theory, and we sum the bulk flows, we get something like the brown or kind of dark orange curves. So we see this decoherence on small scales, and the model error would be large on kind of K of 0.2, 0.3 kind of scales. But if we use these what we call shifted operators, which are basically the linear density or the linear density squared shifted by the bulk flows, then we get this light orange curve, which is a constant error power spectrum. That's what we want, right? We kind of want a shot noise like mistake for the model, because that's how we analyze data. We're kind of saying, okay, there's our model, and then we add some kind of free shot noise on top of that. And this model error, like the mistake that the model makes, is kind of some noise contribution to the model. So it should be treated like a shot noise. But if it has scale dependence, that's really dangerous, right? Because that could kind of, you could think that's maybe neutrino mass or some other kind of physical effect. So we really have to make sure that we use a model that has no scale dependence in the noise. And what we find is that once we account for the bulk flows, we obtain such a model.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, great. Okay, now recently this has been used. This model the same model as the one that we have analyzed here has been used for data analysis. And by the same model, I mean, if we take that model that we have written down here, which is just a standard bias model, but if we include the bulk flows, we get a slightly different model. And if we compute the power spectrum of that model, we get something that's identical to the power spectrum that's been used recently for reanalyzing SDSS BOSS data. So what that means is that kind of field level study that we did is kind of some additional piece of evidence that the model kind of works when you compare it against simulations, right? So it's not completely made up, but kind of, you know, it's not just fitting the power spectrum and maybe bias spectrum, but it's also kind of giving reasonable predictions at the field level when compared against simulations, which is nice to have. And Misha Ivanov, and, you know, I mean, there were kind of two big, a couple of big papers that did that, but, you know, I was mostly seeing this very nice work evolve at the IAS with Misha Ivanov and Markus Monowicz and Matthias Salariaga, right? So they kind of pushed this this modeling forward to really, to reanalyze the bus data, and they got these really nice constraints where they showed that if you use the galaxies alone and don't use any priors from the CMB, you can constrain some parameters as well as the CMB, right? Especially if you look at the Hubble parameter, you get a constraint on the Hubble parameter that's consistent with the CMB and has similar error bars. And it's really an independent measurement, which is really useful if you want to make progress, I guess, on this kind of Hubble tension topic. And they've had more papers that I encourage you to check out. Let me continue. So what we've done very recently was to extend that further to redshift space, right? So what I've shown you so far was just real space. There was no kind of displacement of the galaxies due to redshift space distortions. Just to kind of back up a little bit, right? So what we observe in galaxy surveys is not really the 3D position, but what we do is we kind of measure a spectrum of each galaxy. Then we identify, usually, you know, we would identify certain spectral lines in that spectrum. We see how much they are shifted from kind of, the rest from kind of what we would expect on Earth. And that kind of tells us how much, you know, what's the redshift of that galaxy. And we use that to infer the distance of the galaxy from Earth. Now, if a galaxy has a velocity, it has this kind of Doppler effect. So the redshift that we see is kind of, given by the true distance plus the velocity of the peculiar velocity of whatever the galaxy is that we're looking at. And that distorts our kind of our galaxy catalog, right? Because the velocities kind of change every single position that we look at. So the question was, can we model this redshift space distortions again using this field level modeling approach? So we had a look at that let me just talk you through what we found here. So here's kind of a figure where we show on the left the linear density in a realization, or a 2D slice through the linear density. In the second panel, there is the Seldovich density, which is close to what you would observe in, that's kind of some kind of simple model for the large scale structure. And then the right panels show a prediction, a theory prediction for the velocity field. So what you can see is there's the X component. Yellow means that the velocity is large and positive. So what you can see is that kind of in the left half of the plot, structures kind of move, or particles move towards that kind of central big cluster in the middle. On the right of the plot, they move towards the left. And then if you look at the last panel on the right, you see that's kind of the Y velocity. And here you also see that things move from bottom upwards and from top down. So you kind of see this kind of coherent large scale flow towards the central clustered region here. And what's kind of nice to see, I guess, is that this is really a large scale field, right? You can really see that this velocity is totally dominated by large scale modes, right? Which is what we expect theoretically. Now we want to compare this against simulations, and there's some kind of ambiguity how to do that, because in simulations we only have individual objects. We cannot really compute the velocity at every kind of location in the simulated volume. So what we are showing here is really just the velocity at the positions of simulated halos. And we compare that against the model prediction. What we find is that there is fairly good agreement between the coherent flows, right? But there is some, there's a large mistake when you go to the very clustered regions. And of course, these are kind of satellite galaxies. So these are kind of small galaxies that sit in large halos that kind of spin around in the large halo, right? And they would have huge velocities. So there's no way we can we can hope to model that with a simple perturbation theory based model. So in that case, you know, the velocities just look like random, the model makes a huge mistake. But for the large scale modes, it seems like the model that we wrote down, which is just Lagrangian perturbation theory, seems to work fairly well. Looking more at this point, right? So here I'm again showing 2D slices. Now comparing the real space simulation with the real space model in the left two panels. And if you look at that magenta box, so that's kind of, you know, the same kind of location in the real space model. Now the right two panels show the same in redshift space. So you see that in the simulation and in the model, this kind of structure that's in the magenta box moves downwards. So that's kind of a large scale flow that's captured by the model. But if you look at the clustered regions that are shown, that are indicated by this magenta arrow, there are kind of these finger of God effects where along the line of sight, galaxies just move randomly up and down depending on what their velocity is, right? And we can kind of see this in the simulation, but the model is not able to capture that, right? So it doesn't do this kind of finger of God splitting of the galaxies. And that's kind of expected, right? That's just where the model has no chance to model that. Now looking at this more quantitatively, we again measure this error power spectrum, right? So we take the simulation, we subtract the model prediction, and we compute this power spectrum. And this is shown in the bottom left. So what you see is the dashed lines are the simulation, different colors are different directions to the line of sight. And then the solid lines are the error of the model. And you see it's fairly flat on large scales, but as you go to smaller scales, there is kind of a small increase, and that's kind of shown in the zoom in on the right, which has a linear y scale. So what you can see here is that along the line of sight, the model mistake becomes larger, which makes sense because these velocities kind of become more and more important, and we kind of model them as well. And also, if you just theoretically write down what the expected shape of the error power spectrum is, you find that there should be a k squared mu squared dependence. And indeed, if we try to fit this error power spectrum, we find that fitting it with a k squared mu squared works well. There should also be a k squared in here, but with the tests that we did, we didn't really need it, right? It could still be there, but you know, the fits were also fine without including that additional k squared term. And that might just be dependent on the galaxy sample that you're looking at. So for this galaxy sample, it seems like the error power spectrum is well described by this constant plus k squared mu squared term. So that's reassuring, and it shows that we kind of have a field level model for galaxies in redshift space that works reasonably well up to reasonably small scales.
So what galaxies actually were being used here? So your C1 number is like below one. So that means, I guess, that the error you're getting is like below like the 1/n Poisson noise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that that's something that just depends on halo mass, right? So I forget which way it goes, right? But depending on if you have high or low halo mass, the Poisson the error is either below or above Poisson shot noise.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I think we use these PT challenge galaxies, I think we ran a Rockstar halo finder. And so given these MP gadget simulations, which are full in-body simulations, I run the Rockstar halo finder and then use all the Rockstar halos and populate them with galaxies using some prescription that depends on the halo mass.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same prescription as what they use in this PT challenge paper by IAS, IPMU, and Stanford people.
right. Okay. But the halo mass, I guess, was like somewhat bigger than Milky Way, I guess, then? Or do you recall?
Not off the top of my head, but I think it was made to be similar to Bosch galaxies.
Okay, great, thanks.
Sure. And yeah, I mean, all these conclusions might change if you look at different samples. We haven't, you know, there could be a lot more to explore here. Also, we looked briefly at illustrious galaxies, and there things also, you know, didn't completely fall apart. but that's something, you know, that could be, I guess, an interesting thing to look at, like what all of this looks like if you look at hydro simulations.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so then kind of some ideas that, you know, were fun to think about, but, you know, are kind of, I guess, challenging to do in practice. So since we have simulations and we know the masses of all the galaxies, we can play some fun games where we weight the galaxies by their mass. And it's known that if you do that, you suppress the Poisson shot noise. The idea is that, you know, if you imagine if you take each galaxy and you just weight it by the dark matter density around it, you would basically get back the dark matter density, which has no Poisson shot noise. And we kind of did that, and we indeed found that if we weight galaxies by their true mass from the simulation, we could get a model error that's 10 times below the Poisson error, which is pretty exciting, right? Because for a lot of future surveys, the limitation might be shot noise, right? So if you have a way to effectively get rid of the shot noise, that can really improve constraints a lot. Now, of course, in reality, it's not so easy to measure the mass of galaxies. So it's not clear how useful this would be in practice. Another thing we found was that if you look at this error power spectrum here, shown for the redshift space model, if we just remove kind of 10, 15% of the galaxies that have the largest mistake, we get a 2 times smaller RSD displacement. So that means we could make a model that works to higher K. Right? So it means that basically there are a few satellite galaxies that really screw up the model. And that's kind of been known before, right? It's kind of like we also see this effect. Now, you could think about, you know, are there maybe ways to find these outliers that, you know, have that are satellite galaxies and really screw up the model? Or, you know, can we maybe find weights that correspond to a mass weighting without really measuring the mass directly? And we've thought a little bit about this. And one thing that one can do is one could see this as a kind of optimization problem in high dimensions, right? So you could say, the weight of each galaxy is a free parameter, and I'm going to do gradient descent and to figure out the weight of each galaxy to optimize some objective. What that objective might be is kind of you know, something to figure out, I guess. But one thing that you could do is you could, for example, maximize the quadrupole over monopole ratio at high K. That would suppress fingers of God, because fingers of God kind of push down the quadrupole, right? So if you maximize the quadrupole, that kind of suppresses fingers of God. If you suppress the monopole, you're kind of reducing shot noise. So that would be kind of one objective that you could try to optimize in order to get rid of large RSD mistakes, and maybe also getting something like mass weighting by reducing the shot noise. Now, of course, you might say, okay, that's crazy. You cannot, you know, take your data and assign a you know, some kind of number to each data point and get something out of it. But note that what one can do is, and Andre and Will Percival and Neil kind of had a nice paper on that, is you can weight each galaxy by local properties of the of the galaxies and still use that bias model, right? As long as you're using you know, for example, if you weight things by colors of the observed galaxy, that's kind of a local property of the galaxy. So then you don't invalidate the assumptions of the bias model. So you can still use the Hadoop or galaxy bias model to describe your data. But you might be able to really reduce the noise of your data. So that, you know, that's kind of an interesting idea, but it's you know, it's, I guess it's difficult to do in practice, and you know, requires much more work.
Yeah, I have a question. So isn't there a danger that you will bias your results in this way? Well, if you do this optimization of the ratio, right. then the other multipoles can come out biased. I mean something can come out biased. Yeah.
It depends on what you mean biased, right? So if I think I can do so, you know, if I write down a function of all the local properties of a galaxy that I observe, I can still describe that field by a galaxy bias model, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So all the bias parameters will be wrong. That's right. Or like, you know, they will be different. But I think cosmological parameters should still be okay, right?
That's what I'm worried about. So won't they move? That's because you kind of artificially move because you played with your data.
I think you're allowed to play with your data as long as, you know, I think the hope here would be as long as you're only making local changes to your, you know, if you're only changing each observable, well, as long as you're changing each point only dependent on some function of the local properties of each thing, you're not really, you know, you're not really changing the kind of, you're only changing the bias model, right? You're only changing the prescription of how the dark matter goes into galaxies. You're basically making up a new galaxy sample, right? And you could think of like, you know, if you had a different telescope that observes different galaxies, you would do the same thing, right? So, you know, the hope would be that you would only change your bias parameters, but not the cosmological parameters.
Okay.
But, you know, it's kind of like, who knows? I don't know.
But it's not obvious. Anyway.
No, I don't think. Well, it's not obvious. I see. Okay. I agree. I guess the way to screw this up is like if you were to use like neighbor information, right? If you were to say like, you know, take each galaxy and kind of weight it by properties of a galaxy 20 megaparsec away, mm-hmm. then I think you would make a mistake that kind of, you know, is given by the 20 megaparsec distance between the galaxies, right? Because you're using stuff that's further away, which you're not allowed to do in the bias model, right? But if you're only using stuff at the same location, then, you know, it should be okay, I guess. But
I see.
I don't know.
Okay. Yeah.
But these properties that you're using, you know, to like reweight the field, like, you know, do those properties include things like the local density?
Yeah, I mean, if you do that, I think you're going to introduce a mistake that depends on like how large the radius is in which you compute the density, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Okay. Right. So yeah, I wouldn't want to use that, right? I would rather use like, you know, properties of the spectra of the galaxies, for example.
Okay, I see. Right. Okay. Right. Yeah. Like things like colors or.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. I see.
But like, you know, who knows, right? It's just an idea. We've just like, I guess, played with that and, you know, some kind of simulated setups. I guess what I was surprised by is that you can actually do this optimization, right? So it turns out that evaluating the gradient descent, you can just do with FFTs, right? So it's really not expensive to do this, right? You can, running a simulation is more expensive than doing this optimization. The real hard part is like, you know, how to figure out these properties from the observations mm-hmm. and doing this in a real world setup.
So actually this optimization, I mean, this picture reminds machine learning mm-hmm. and they have very fast algorithms. I don't know if you try to apply them to your problem.
This is machine learning in the sense that you do gradient descent in a high number of dimensions and the gradient is fast to evaluate. That's mm-hmm. right. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, the reason why the gradients are fast to evaluate here is that we have a continuous model, right? So we can just write on a formula for the gradient. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that that formula just involves FFTs. Right?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. And I think I'm kind of running out of time, so I should probably stop. I was going to talk about bias spectra. So maybe just quickly, I should mention that, you know, some recent work that I finished with Azadeh Martinezat in Geneva. There we were looking at these skew spectra, which are basically cross spectra between quadratic fields and the density. So the simplest kind of observable we would look at would be something like take the density, square it to get delta squared, and then correlate that with the density, which is something that people have been doing in the CMB forever, but in large scale structure it's kind of not been used that much, right? And the question there was, can you do this kind of delta squared delta skew spectra in a way that you capture redshift space bias spectrum information? And what we did in that recent paper was to look at the leading order, the tree level bias spectrum in redshift space, identify all the different terms that you have there, and construct a skew spectrum for each term that appears in that bias spectrum. And then we can measure this skew spectra, and what is shown here is basically this 14 skew spectra that we get compared between some simulation and the prediction. And we generally find good agreement on large scales. And Asadeh is kind of pushing this now to make it more realistic, to perhaps go to real data at some point. And the hope would be that, you know, this could maybe be a cheap way to get at bispectrum information, because you never have to think about triangles, right? You're just computing squared fields. And with some kind of filtering operations that are not that difficult to do, so at least, you know, in simulation. So, you know, the hope would be that maybe this could give some kind of cheaper bispectrum information than what people usually do. And here it's just a plot showing that this might be potentially used to obtain bias parameters, for example. And there's more work to do there. Okay, so let me stop. Sorry, I had more slides, didn't like throw them out. So let me just show this. So the codes for the things that I mentioned are on GitHub, so feel free to use them. If you have, or also simulations, if you want to have them, I'm happy to share. If you have questions about any of this, feel free to send me an email. Neil mentioned in the beginning, I recently moved to a hedge fund job. So if you have any questions about that, feel free to email me, and I'm happy to talk about that as well. Otherwise, thanks for your attention.
Okay, great. So thanks, Marcel. So let's all unmute to give him a round of applause for his very interesting talk. Okay, so we've had a bunch of questions. Are there any further questions for Marcel? So feel free just to jump in if you have a question.
Yes, I have the question. Am I right that your model does contain the contour terms for dark matter? Your theoretical model. I mean K squared P of T, P of K, which is proportional to the K squared.
We are basically using these transfer functions that are free functions of K, and so they can account for that. Yeah.
I mean, this contour term allows you to move to the smaller scales. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. So in the B1 of K, there is effectively a CS included there. That's right. And we need to include that to fit the measured B1 of K. That's in the real space paper, I think, mostly. Or we looked into that much more detail in the real space paper.
In the real space paper, you show the evidence for the quantum term, yeah? In the real space.
I'm not sure if we show like real evidence for it, but we show that if we include it, we can fit the B1. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if we showed that without it, we can also fit it. But you know, if we include it, we can't fit it. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Quite okay.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because I showed the fingers of the gut should be rather high for small scales. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, so I probably missed. So how do you treat the fingers of God at the end? You just cut away the region where there are fingers of God. You don't model it?
We don't treat them at all, right? We just we don't try to model them. They are part of whatever the error is, and it turns out on large scales the error just goes like k squared mu squared. Right. So yeah, I mean, we make no attempt to model fingers of God,
and neither impose any cuts to get them out. Or
that's an interesting question, right? So you can impose cuts, right? And they should probably be mu dependent, right? Another thing you could do is you could say like, if I know that the error power spectrum goes like k squared mu squared. I can kind of, you know, just include a noise that basically I can increase the shot noise along the line of sight, right? Mm-hmm. And then maybe I can go to higher K using that. So yeah, there are like some ideas that it's a good area to explore. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We haven't really looked too much into that, right? We've just measured the error power spectrum.
So any further questions? I don't see any hands raised. Okay, so if not, then let's stop the recording here. Thanks again, Marcel, for your very interesting talk. And thanks everyone else for coming.
Yeah, thanks everyone.